Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Safe Space, the official Safe in Our World podcast. For those who don't know, the main goal of Safe in Our World is to create and foster worldwide mental health awareness within the video games industry. My name is Rosie, and today I am joined by the wonderful Dr. Rachel Cowart. Rachel is a research psychologist and research director for Take This, as well as a creator of content from books to her YouTube channel, Psychgeist, which bridges the gap between moral panic and scientific knowledge on the psychology and games. And she was also very recently announced in the Game Awards Future Class of 2021, which is amazing. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. I'd love for you to tell me a bit about yourself, because it was like so hard to try and find an introduction to do you justice of getting everything in there.
Oh, you're so kind. You're so kind. I think, you know, it's all pretty good in there. I mean, I'm a research psychologist. I have been studying games and gamers for more than 10 years. With a specific focus on the way that games impact us physically, socially, and psychologically. And as you mentioned, I work for Take This, which is a mental health nonprofit, which, similar to Safe in Our World, wants to destigmatize mental health challenges and bring mental health awareness to the gaming industry and gaming communities. So I'm so happy to be here to talk to a fellow kindred spirit.
I know, it's so nice. And we've kind of like crossed paths a few times within... since I've been at Safe in Our World, at least, and I know that we've been together on like the Mental Health Foundation research family thing, which is always really fun. So it's nice to actually finally have a conversation.
Absolutely.
So, and I know you already know what the question is going to be, but I have got to ask before we start into the real, you know, not that this isn't interesting, but the real psychology and games talk, I need to know what a Cavill influencer is and what what it means. I'm so
intrigued. Oh, Rosie. You know, I just said the other day, like, forget the PhD, forget the science. Let's talk about Cavill influencing. It is my claim to fame. I am a big fan of Henry Cavill. Mm-hmm. And I honestly really discovered him from season one in The Witcher. And I had put off watching The Witcher for a long time just because, like, life. And everyone was like, you got to watch it. You got to watch it. And when I sat down to watch it, I was, like, completely enthralled in, like, the first 5 minutes. And a lot of that has to do with, and I'm sure a lot of people agree, Henry Cavill is an amazing Geralt of Rivia. So I jumped on the bandwagon of, like, Team Henry Cavill, and it's kind of become a running thing in my YouTube videos. Like, if you watch my YouTube videos, he gets mentioned a lot. Even when you think maybe it's not relevant, I somehow managed to get that in there. And I also, it became a running gag. So last year in my media interviews, I made it a challenge to see if I can mention The Witcher and Henry Cavill in, like, all of my interviews. Really? And I managed to get it on, like, Nintendo Life and live French news. And, like, I just really worked it hard. And so in the end, I feel like I've earned my title of Cavill influencer. And the Netflix account for The Witcher has endorsed this decision.
It is screenshot really?
Forever memorial. Yes. You know, I tweeted at them and they tweeted at me and I said, you see, Twitter, I told you I was a Cavill influencer. I'm going to put it in my bio. And they responded, we'll allow it. So here we are.
This is amazing. So you are the only official Cavill influencer in the world.
That is absolutely. And I will take that. It'll go on my tombstone.
So
I'm very
guess
proud.
The only next logical step is for you to meet Henry Cavill, if you haven't already.
Obviously. I have not already. But as you mentioned, I am a member of the Game Awards Future Class. And part of that package or getting selected for that is you get to go to the Video Game Awards. So I'm really campaigning hard, you know, to get Henry Cavill at those awards so our worlds can finally collide. I mean, like you said, it's the next natural step.
Absolutely. This is amazing. I'm so excited. I'm just waiting for the Instagram post or the Twitter post or something where it's finally together.
Me too.
Oh, I love it. Thank you for sharing that. That really made my day. So kind of moving into the psychology aspect of your life and your career, mm-hmm. I was wondering whether you could tell me a little bit about what got you into looking specifically into the relationships between psychology and games in the first place.
Yeah, it was not really a straightforward path. I've played games my entire life, and I also, from a pretty early on in my career, I'll say, when I started my undergraduate studies at the University of Texas, I knew I wanted a career in psychology. And if you want a career in psychology, you pretty much have to have a graduate degree to do anything really kind of deep in the field. So I got my undergraduate in psych, and then I went to get my master's in counseling psychology. And when I was doing that, you know, training to become a therapist, you have to obviously do an internship where you do therapy. And I was seeing parent after parent after parent expressing concern about World of Warcraft and the impact that World of Warcraft was having, because this was like height World of Warcraft era. And I was like, oh, full disclosure, like I play like loads of World of Warcraft. So like now I'm concerned that you're concerned. And at the time, this is like 2005-ish, there wasn't research on this stuff. It didn't really exist. There were one or two papers, maybe, about the uses and effects of games, which I found surprising because the concern at this point was very widespread, not just in my little corner of the world. So that's when I decided to pivot to a research-based PhD instead of a clinically-based PsyD or PhD and study the uses and effects of games.
Fascinating. That's so interesting. And I kind of, that was one of the points I wanted to touch on, was that there is still kind of not that much research going on between psychology and game. It's growing, absolutely. But even since I've been in post, I've struggled to find a lot of things that I actually want conclusive evidence or support for. And it's really hard to find like non-biased, credible research.
Yeah, you know, it's a growing field. It's definitely better now than it was, you know, 15 years ago. But yeah, there's still a lot to be discovered, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you had a really interesting thread on Twitter, I think, talking about how, because obviously there's a lot of stories within the media that kind of try to panic people into worrying about games, worrying about screen time. And there was one specific one that you talked about in the New York Times that's about children's screen time, and it's alarming parents and researchers. And I just wondered whether you can elaborate a little bit on that and talk about how you are like myth busting, because I think it's great.
Yeah, it's I do go on rants from Twitter from time to time. It is something I enjoy doing. You know, moral panic in and around games is really infuriating because it's scapegoating games for something that research has very much dismissed, you know, that it could possibly be doing, like games making you violent. Like that's pretty much agreed upon in the research community. The vast majority of researchers would agree that the evidence does not support that. But yet we still see headlines, you know, when something terrible happens that, oh, they played video games and it must be the video games. So this New York Times article really rubbed me the wrong way for a lot of reasons, but it pulled at a lot of the threads of moral panic, like, oh, if they're playing games, you know, they must be overweight. If they're playing games, they must be antisocial. And there's a quote in that article that says something to the effect of like, this kid's parents are so upset and they say to him, well, when you're mad at your spouse later in life, what are you going to go do? Are you going to go play Xbox? And it's like, yes, you are. And yeah, you can, because games are great for stress relief. Games are great for escaping. And, you know, escapism is not inherently a bad thing. We all do it all the time. It's a healthy, good thing that we should do. Of course, we don't want it to negatively impact our lives, but, you know, we all need a break every now and then. So the New York Times one, I think it also resonated with a lot of people. It's the pinned tweet on my Twitter, actually, because it's a really good example of a single article that really touches all the points, you know, addiction, aggression, antisocial, totally negating any discussion about the positive mental health benefits of games, like stress relief, like social connection. Yeah, it gets me very much on my soapbox, especially New York Times. And then I heard that specific article was printed on the front page of the New York Times. And I was like, no.
Even worse. I think, I mean, you must get this too, but ever since I joined Safe in Our World as like a video games / mental health charity, everyone for some reason seems to initially assume that it's to do with looking into the negative effects of it rather than the positive, which always baffles me. And I don't know whether you've experienced the same sort of thing with Take This when you try and explain your job role.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, a couple years ago, I edited a book called Video Games and Wellbeing. And it's the first book to be published that specifically focuses on the positive impacts of games. Because even my own previous work, you always have to hit the addiction, aggression, antisocial, you always have to hit those notes because that is the only thing people want to talk about. And why I say research has gone forward and why it's so infuriating is we have a lot of answers now. We know that being overweight is an artifact of the 21st century lifestyle. It's not just games. We know that games don't have long-term impacts on aggression. We know that there's no evidence to suggest that games are inherently addicting. Yep, that's all we want to talk about. Why can't we talk about, you know, social connection, especially during the pandemic? Why can't we talk about games being great, fantastic tools for learning? A whole range of things. So yeah, I was optimistic at the start of the pandemic that the narrative would change and we would start focusing more on the positive. And we did for like a hot minute, and then it
slowly disintegrated into
That's what it was before.
Oh gosh, yeah, pretty much. I mean, I always, it's just disappointing, I guess, when you only ever see it in the news that it's always particularly negative things about it. And it's always, I think, unfairly weighted in games rather than anything else in terms of films and TV and like any other entertainment industry. It's always games that get the rap of it.
Yes, Rosie, yes. And to take it back to your initial question about The Witcher, okay? I work it in.
Nice.
The first time I actually mentioned Henry Cavill and The Witcher and the work that I do, and it spawned everything, was about escapism specifically, because I had just watched season one and I had binge watched. Binge already is a negatively slanted word, but you know, we all just say, oh, I binge watch like it's no big deal. I binge watch The Witcher in like a single setting, and nobody bats an eye when I say that. But if I tell you I spent 8 hours playing the Final Fantasy VII remake, first of all, you'd say, why haven't you finished it yet? But second of all, you would be like, that seems like something unhealthy. And why is it only with games? Because if nothing else, games are a more active form of entertainment. I could
be
socializing, right? So what is it about that? I mean, it's just the perception, because like tangibly, you know, it's not in any way less. And if anything, it's better and more.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you're not just watching something, like you're actively engaging with it and you're using your brain to try and like problem solve and communicate with people. And there's so much. I guess we're so frustrated. And I feel like I can't articulate what I feel like. So I just like listening to you and being like, yeah, I agree.
it's just a loud sigh. That's the articulation.
I know. I had to say to someone the other day, like they were talking about something. I can't remember what it was. And I was silent and they were like, oh, are you still there? I was like, sorry, yeah. My eyes were just like rolling into the back of my head because I was so frustrated. But obviously we're not on camera, so you can't see that. And I was just silently raging. Yeah. And that's not a great thing to do on a podcast because no one's watching.
Yeah. Relatable though.
Oh, it really is. So how do you think, since beginning your journey in games and psychology, how do you think it's kind of progressed since the beginning to now, I guess?
I mean, it's definitely grown as a field, which is exciting to see, because, you know, when I started studying games in my PhD, I remember my interview. I actually went to University of York for my PhD.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Around York.
Did you? I love England so much. If I could live anywhere in the world, it would be there. And when I started when I did my interview for that position, I was saying we need to study the uses and effects of games and blah, blah, blah. But I was constantly justifying the importance of games. And every time I gave a talk, I had to open with games are a billion-dollar industry and games are important and this is why. Fast forward to now, there are entire labs dedicated to the study of games. Like Finland has a great one and Denmark has a great one. They're all over the world that are taking PhD students, right, without having to make that uphill battle of this is why games matter. Like people understand now that games matter. And that's probably been the most exciting change. that I've seen from when I started to today. Because as we already mentioned, in terms of the dialogues, those aren't changing much what we're saying about games, which is really frustrating. But and there's a lot more, I think, work looking into the positive effects of games now, like games in mental health and games in education, whereas before it was very, very focused on aggression, addiction, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think one thing as well that might put it into perspective for like people who aren't usually aware of the impact that games is having is that something that surprised me in the news, obviously Activision Blizzard has now been acquired by Microsoft, which was for something ridiculous like $70 billion or something. I don't know how much it was a lot of money. And then it compared it to the takeover of Marvel, which was for like $9 billion. Mm-hmm. And that's like I can't even process how much billions are, but when you compare how massive Marvel is to that, like, it just shows how huge games can be within the world. That I don't know.
Yeah, games are incredible. I mean, they're bigger than the music, movie, and television industries combined.
Yeah,
and have been for an extended period of time. And when we talk about it, we're like, yeah, of course, obviously, we know that. But when I say that to a room of people at York when I first started, they were like, really? Yes, really.
It's fascinating. I love it. And then, so what are you working on right now then in terms of your research and your work in psychology and games?
Yeah, my work has pivoted quite a bit throughout my career. And when I joined Take This, my work became definitely a little more industry focused because we have outreach for the industry as well as gaming communities. Mm-hmm. Today, my work is kind of more focused on the dark side. So I call them dark participation in gaming, trolling, doxing, toxic behavior generally, and looking at the prevalence of that and how we can develop strategies to combat it, both from the top down, so from industry focused strategies, and the bottom up, which are like community focused strategies. So just trying to make the gaming world a little bit of a better place. I like to talk about the positive sides of games, but you know, there is also negative things to consider, especially when it comes to kind of the social aspects, the cultural aspects of gaming on the more negative, darker side.
Yeah, no, I think it's great to talk about positives, but it's very important to highlight what is wrong with it so that people can start to make better change and positive change within it, because I've certainly, especially seen this year, a lot of issues with like streaming and Twitch and negativity within that, which I was not aware of until last year. And it's just, it ruins the whole thing. It ruins gaming communities, and it almost gives people, I think, an excuse to then doubt the whole system and and not see the positives coming through because...
Yeah, because there's just a lot. Yeah.
There's a lot.
It's hard because, you know, games began as an activity for the misfits and the outcasts, right? And then you flash forward to today and you would think that games are only for cis heterosexual white men because anyone who's not that is mistreated in some way. And that's not okay because games are for everyone. So we want everyone to feel welcome.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some certain outrages that have really frustrated me, obviously, to do with anyone who's not a cis straight white man.
Yeah, but right.
Also, the fact that it's like people got upset when people realized that people were using difficulty settings as they should be used.
Oh my gosh, that's absolutely absurd, Rosie. I mean,
I know. How dare you play the game that's an option on the actual game? You want to play it?
How
it's
you want
not meant
to, play
to be
game.
Fun? Gosh.
Yeah. How dare you? How dare you? I know. It's ridiculous. Gatekeeping is yucky. That's the technical word for it.
Oh, yucky! What a good word. I'm gonna start using that more.
Yeah.
I feel like my accent gives it a bit more of like, oh, you know,
it
yuck.
Does. It does.
Oh, amazing. I'd like to ask you about Zeitgeist, and I really hope I pronounced that right as well, because I didn't ask you about that pronunciation beforehand. So yeah, talk to me a little bit about Zeitgeist and why you started it and what it's all about.
I've always been interested in scientific communication and getting scientific information out of the ivory tower, so to say. Back in 2015, 2018 somewhere, 2018, I don't know, it's early. I published a book called The Video Game Debate. And when I published that book, my whole idea was I'm going to take all this information that we have in game studies and I'm going to put it all together so the general audience would be really interested in this. Parents would like this, teachers would like this, blah, blah, blah. And I published the book, and the book is great, but now as a parent, I realize, no, it's too long. People don't have time for that. No one's reading that unless they are at a university. So flash forward to the pandemic, when we all had more time on our hands, and I was like, you know what would actually be a better way to outreach people? YouTube. So that's when I started Sitegeist, and I mean, as I said, I've always been interested in how can I take this information in a way that's relatable? How can I express the thousands of research studies we have about violent video games and how they don't lead to violent behavior in a way in which people can hear it, people can digest it, and people can relay it to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of my mission with that channel. And I've really enjoyed making these videos. And if I knew how useful they would be, I would have done it a long time ago, because I can't tell you, Rosie, how many times people are like, violent video games. And I'm like, ah, there's a video for that. So I don't have to repeat myself 100,000 times.
No, you know, it's impressive because I did a degree. It wasn't related to psychology at all. It was zoology and it was ridiculous. Cool. But I understand the level of work that has to go into research projects. And I think it's really impressive that you are able to very concisely put all of the important points into a video and not want to talk about it for ages, because that's the one thing I always struggled with, is I'd want to explain everything and why and go into all the methodology behind it. And yeah, I just think you've done a great job with being able to just narrow it all down into one short video that just explains it in a nice friendly way to people who might not be in the research field. So it's great.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. That was the goal. And it's not my natural inclination, because as a recovering academic, as I like to say, in a way that's understandable and relatable, is not natural for me. So for me, when I write these scripts, I like write them and then I spend like five times as long editing them. Cause I'm like, no, Rachel, they don't need to know how many participants were in this study. They just need to know what the findings were.
Oh, yeah, but it's so tempting to tell them.
I know. But that's why I still publish academically. So I still get that out to the world.
Okay, nice. And do you think, like, how do you think it's evolved, I guess, when you first started it to now? And where do you see it moving in the next couple of years?
It's definitely evolved. I started with one video a week, which was far too much content for me to produce as a mother of three and also employed. I think that in the last year, I've really learned what it is that people want to see and what kind of content I make that people enjoy the most. So like those state of the research videos I make. So like, what do we know about everything about the topic of aggression and video games, or everything we know about the topic of toxicity in games? Those seem to resonate a lot. So I'm focusing my energy more on that kind of content. And I'm also kind of branching out into more generalized content, because everyone is interested in games generally, but not everyone is always interested in the science. So like this year I launched a new set of videos that I'm doing with Dr. Sarah Hayes called Reaction Time. She is a licensed clinical practitioner. I have a master's in counseling psychology, and we watch television and film portrayals of therapists and basically take the piss out of all of them. And that's really fun. And I feel like everyone can relate to that, right? Everyone kind of finds that interesting, and maybe they'll come for that and then like stay for science.
Yeah, totally. Because I always think it's interesting if you're not a specialist and you watch a TV show, but you never really know how accurate it is. Like I've recently started watching these exact things, but like with lawyers and doctors and things like that. And I find it fascinating that sometimes it's just how wrong TV shows and films can be about certain,
so wrong.
Certain profession. Oh, it's like they don't try and do any research beforehand.
Oh my gosh. And then the problem is people think that's how therapy is. No, your therapist should not be trying to date you. Why is that like every show?
I know, it's so unethical, a lot of the things. And especially when they're like targeted towards younger people. I'm like, no, this is dangerous. Like, stop giving the impression that this is normal because it's not.
I think that Dr. Sarah and I are always like, they are going to lose their license. Like, what is happening? That is not real life.
Yeah, absolutely. That's always the common theme, is that they'd be like, they wouldn't have a job at the end of this episode if this was real life.
Definitely not. They'd be in jail. That's bad.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Just thinking about research specifically, mm-hmm. and what would be like your ultimate thing to research within games and psychology? Like, do you have an ultimate goal that you're like, yes, I want to research that 5 years in the future, 10, like, I want to dedicate this amount of time to it. Into it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if money was no object,
absolutely. Yeah. This is all hypothetical. Yeah. Like, you have all the time in the world, all of the money in the world. Oh,
this is great. All the resources. I have been really interested in doing a study that follows the same players over time. These studies are really expensive and really hard to do. Originally, I wanted to look at maybe something in the vein of gaming addiction, which, if you follow my YouTube channel, you know that I am not a proponent of the IGD diagnosis of gaming addiction. There's no research to suggest games themselves are addicting, but rather they're a maladaptive coping strategy that somehow turned, you know, maladaptive, whether it's for environmental stress or anxiety, depression, what have you. So I would love to follow a group of people over an extended period of time to actually really be able to demonstrate that, you know, numerically, that what is driving this behavior, if the behavior comes to a point that it is problematic, is it related to depression or environmental stress or anxiety? Is it related to some other factor that's going on? To kind of definitively show, like, there's nothing unique and specific about games that would drive a behavior that would be considered clinically, quote unquote, air quotes, you can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, addicting. So that would probably be the ultimate. But, you know, those studies are very, very expensive and require very long grant applications.
Yeah, but they would be really, really valuable if you're ever to do them. So
yeah, it'd be great.
So here for it. So for those who might not know, would you be able to explain a little bit about what gaming disorder is?
Sure.
Or not, and common misconceptions around it? Absolutely. I think it's really fascinating.
And the World Health Organization in 2019 said they were going to classify internet gaming disorder in their diagnostic manual. So this is the manual that medical doctors and psychologists would use to diagnose anything. So depression or gambling addiction, and then now gaming disorder. What's notable is that they went forward with this diagnosis and classification of gaming disorder, despite the fact that the research evidence doesn't support it. So a whole host of scholars in the field sent an open letter saying, we don't think you should do this, because you might be basically taking the coping strategy away from people. If there's no evidence to say that games are this significant problem, by saying that they are, if people present themselves for gaming disorder and you're like, oh, we just got to take the games away and put them in some kind of rehab facility, you could be causing more harm than good. And that has kind of been the active debate back and forth. The World Health Organization has since come back and said they will still go forward with this classification. But now more evidence has come out to suggest that this was a politically motivated decision. There's some emails lurking around the internet to further, you know, reinforce this idea that it's not based on evidence. People have asked for the evidence that the World Health Organization used for this classification. They have failed to provide it publicly. So it's a bit of a murky territory, you know, and I tell people, if you feel like games are leading to significant problems in your life, I absolutely reach out to a mental health professional. If you feel like your child is suffering consequences, reach out, but be mindful of finding a therapist that is culturally competent about the uses and effects of games, so they can have an understanding that maybe games are the coping strategy that have then turned problematic, but not that games themselves are the source of the problem.
Mic drop.
I get it
from the rooftop. I love it. It's so good. It's just that's the thing. Like, nothing I don't think is inherently bad. I think it's all to do with the relationships of the person and what the activity is. And like, I think overconsumption of anything is could have a negative effect if you're not looking after it. So it's just, it feels very targeted specifically at games for that exact reason, which is why I find it so frustrating.
Yes, absolutely. Which is why, surprising no one, that these emails are coming out being like, oh, there's a lot of pressure, political pressure to put this in. Because like you said, like the research, like, you know, it doesn't support it. And too much water is bad for you. So
exactly. But no one would ever say that, would they? Yeah. No one ever would talk about too much fruit, too much vegetable.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got another question for you. If you weren't doing games and psychology, what do you think you would, and that's games and or psychology, what do you think you would be keen to study outside of those two?
Oh, that's hard, because, you know, I've wanted to study psychology forever. I would have liked to pursue a career in medicine and being a real doctor.
But you are a real doctor.
I know. I'm a doctor of medicine.
Sure.
But I was just really terrible at chemistry, so that was not going to be an option for me. I think I would have really enjoyed that.
Ah, okay. And then if psychology was an option, but it's not to do with specifically games.
Oh.
I thought I'd start off hard questions and then we'll move into a slightly nicer one.
And get a little easier. I'm really a fan of Jungian like analysis, like psychoanalysis type therapy, you know, where you see your analyst like every single day and you do like real big deep dives and like dream interpretation and that kind of angle of mental health treatment. I probably would have gone that way.
I'm fascinated by dream interpretation because I don't actually know too much about the science behind it. I just find it interesting when it often aligns with what's actually going on. And I'm like, is it a coincidence? Yeah. Is it not? Maybe it's both, but...
It is really interesting. In my master's, I took a course on it. And, you know, it is really fascinating, especially like Jungian perspectives. We're going to get a little nerdy. Jungian perspectives, it's all about collective unconscious and like shared association. So it's like, oh, the snake has always meant this in like all the different cultures. And so the idea is that's how we interpret what a snake means in a dream, because it's like a universal symbol. Oh, that's very cool.
What does it mean? Because I have dreams about snakes all the time.
Do you? Well, it's associated like with, I can't, like you're putting me on the spot. I don't know exactly, but I know it's associated, you know, the snake is on the sign for medicine. There's like a staff with a snake around it, and the snake is associated with like life and death and like Garden of Eden type stuff. So it kind of goes like all the way back that way.
Oh, I'm going to do some research into it. I feel like I need to do a deep dive on my life and my unconscious.
On your psyche.
Yes, absolutely. Because there must be some truth behind it and some, like if like you've just said, if there's a culture behind a certain image or a certain thing.
Certain symbol. Yes.
Very cool.
And the idea of a collective unconscious, I just like that idea. Because, you know, that all humans are linked by this collective unconscious and ties us all together, and I don't know, very cool.
Yeah, because I can't remember if this is wrong, and please do call me out if it is, because this is going back to like A-level psychology and it's a while ago. But isn't like 70% of the brain or something unconscious?
I complete a lie. That's probably a lie.
My guess is that's like a lie. I feel like it was Freud just messing around.
Yeah, maybe. I cannot confirm or deny, but my guess is that's probably not true.
Okay. And it wouldn't be a Safe in Our World podcast if I didn't ask you about your favorite games and judge you kind of harshly on them. But not really, because I've not played a bunch of games, so I always get judged as well, so we're all good. This is a safe space.
Okay, good. It is called safe space. favorite game of all time is Final Fantasy VI. Always has been, always will be. My favorite game of last year was Unpacking. Have you played Unpacking?
No, but I saw some of your playthrough and it made me really sad. I think there was a moment where you had to put like your PhD or something on the floor under the bed.
That one hurt. That hurt me in my soul. If you haven't seen that video, listeners, you can see it in my face. I am very distraught.
I've never seen like disappointment and devastation so much in someone's face before, and it was beautifully devastating to watch.
It was. It's a beautiful game, and it uses like I kept calling it like inference storytelling. I don't know what you actually call it, but it's just like the way that the environment is designed tells the story, and it's like having to put your PhD under the bed, you know, you realize this person you're living with maybe isn't the right person for you. And it's really, it's a beautiful little indie game. Highly, highly recommend. So that was my favorite one of the last year. But I don't play too many games also because I have three children under, you know, 6 years old. So
yeah, I am truly in awe of how much work that you get done while also having three children. Like, it's amazing.
It's, you know, it's a balancing act, and I have a very supportive spouse, so that helps.
Love it. What do you think would be like some of your most impactful titles in terms of mental health outside of the ones you've already mentioned, do you think?
Sea of Solitude is one I like to mention.
Fantastic game.
Oh, great game. You know, at Take This, we do the Dr. Mark Award, which is an award for mental health representation in games. And we do it every 2 or 3 years. And there's only been two winners. And the first one was Stardew Valley.
Nice.
Which I am a huge fan of.
Yeah.
And the second was Celeste. And I really like Celeste because, you know, have you played it?
I have, and I haven't finished it, and I'm so sad at myself that I haven't done it, but I love it, and I still listen to the OST. It's delightful.
It's a great little game, and again, it's I love mental health storytelling in games, how it's evolved. We talked earlier about how things changed, because it's not as, like, overt, like this person. It's not like Final Fantasy VI, which is my favorite game of all time, and I will die on that hill. But you know, the main bad guy is just like, he's crazy, and he's just crazy because it's crazy, and it's terrible, you know, mental health representation. But you know, with Celeste, you have discussions, nuanced, hopeful discussions about mental health and mental health challenges, and you have the game mechanics built in, you know, with like breathing techniques about how to alleviate panic attacks and anxiety. And it's really just like so multifaceted these days. It's very exciting to see. And, you know, at the Game Awards, they announced Hellblade 2. You know, Hellblade is the gold standard for mental health storytelling.
Absolutely. I am very excited. Oh, there's just so many out there that I love. And I always get really nerdy and just geek out on the podcast whenever people start mentioning games that I love as well. Because huge Stardew Valley fan.
Yes.
Oh, wait, I play that so much.
Who do you romance, Rosie?
Oh, Emily.
Emily, good choice.
Yeah.
I'm a Harvey gal.
I can understand Harvey. Yeah.
You know, Harvey likes cheese and wine. He speaks to me.
That's perfect. Perfect man.
Yeah.
I love Stardew Valley. I like games that I can totally relax into and just not have to really think about for a while, which is
absolutely,
which is super nice. But I will leave it there because I think it's been a really interesting, like, fast-paced, such a random conversation, like, starter, which I really liked. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
No worries at all. And just for those listening, where can people find you on the interweb?
The interweb. You can find me on YouTube at PsychGeist. And you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Coart. I live on Twitter. And if you stay long enough, you'll get enough Witcher than you could ever want. And definitely a rant. Rant every now and then.
Yeah, can vouch. You should go follow her on Twitter. Like, it's pretty great. Amazing. But yeah, thank you so much. And for those listening, if you're struggling, please know that you're not alone. There is a lot of support out there. And if you're looking for somewhere to start, please do visit our website at saferinourworld.org to find a list of global helplines, as well as a lot of information about different feelings and symptoms. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Safe Space, and we'll catch you next time. Bye!